Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome. I'm your host, Memo, and this is Dissected. Welcome to another episode. A little bit about me in the show. I'm a licensed mental health therapist and have an undergraduate degree in criminal justice and forensic psychology. I've always found psychology fascinating, so for this show, I've dissected, researched, and reviewed the biopsychosocial elements of various serial killers and murderers, as well as any diagnoses they may have received. This week, I've decided to do, yet again, something different. I'm going to try something new. Instead of talking about a specific person, I want to talk about serial killers in general. I'll talk about the definition of serial murder and try to give an overall profile of what a serial killer is and why. I hope you like the show. If you have any ideas or suggestions to make the show better, please feel free to email me at dissected.podcast@gmail.com. That's dissected, D-I-S-S-E-C-T-E-D, dot podcast, P-O-D-C-A-S-T, at gmail.com. Please visit and follow the Instagram page at Dissected Podcast. Thank you for joining me, and let's begin. In today's episode, I'm going to dissect and talk about serial murder, or serial killers in general, both. I've done some research and compiled a bunch of information from the FBI, Psychology Today, and several other sources. So I want to start out with the definition of serial murder or serial killers. It's not as simple as you think it might be. So I want to compare this definition to a spree killer and a mass murderer because they're all very close to one another, and the definition of serial killer has changed over time. So let's go through some of this and kind of break it down a little bit. So a serial killer has been defined as typically a person who murders three or more people, usually in service of an abnormal psychological gratification, and where the murders are taking place over more than a month and including a significant period of time between them, like a cooling off period. So comparing that to a spree killer is someone who kills two or more people in a short time in multiple locations. The U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics defines spree killing as killings at two or more locations with almost no time break between the murders. Let's compare another type of murder, mass murder. A mass murder is the act of murdering a number of people, typically simultaneously, over a very short period of time, in close geographic proximity. The FBI defines mass murder as murdering of four or more persons during an event with no cooling off period between the murders. A mass murder typically occurs in a single location where one or more people kill several other people. So, the FBI has a lot of great information about this, and they've done a lot of research. And so they were talking about that in the past 30 years, all these various definitions of serial murder have been used by law enforcement, clinicians, academics, researchers, and a lot of these definitions are quite common to one another. And they talk about requirements, numbers, like things like the numbers of murder and the types of motivation. So what the FBI, there was a symposium set up, and so what they did was they were talking about coming up with a definition of serial murder, and so they wanted to address the discrepancies about serial murder at the symposium, and they looked at all of the various factors. So the different discussion groups at the symposium agreed on a number of similar factors to be included in the definition, and that was one or more offenders. That means one killer or more than one killer, two or more murdered victims. Incidents should be occurring in separate events at different times. And the time period between the murders separates serial murder from mass murder. That's the cooling off period. In combining the various ideas put forth at the symposium, they came up with the following definition. So this is what the FBI's definition is for serial murder. It's the unlawful killing of two or more victims by the same offender or offenders in separate events. What causes people to become a serial killer? It's a great question. If that could be answered, then possibly we wouldn't have any serial killers anymore. That cannot be answered. There's no one test to say, oh, this is what definitely causes it. So it's a mix of factors. It's a very complex mix of factors. It's also based on something that I talk about every week, biopsychosocial. Biological, social, environmental factors, psychological factors, ingrained in the person, how they interact, their upbringing. All of those things are a part of it. And it's like it's a collective outcome of all of these experiences and influences on this person's life. And then they move forward and they make the decision to engage in certain activities. And it's probably not possible to identify all the factors that influence everybody's normal human behavior, but you can identify some, and some of the influences that kind of seem to be common within other serial killers. And some of those are like neglect and abuse in childhood seems to lead to an increased risk. There's also substance abuse seems to play a huge part in it. Increased aggression and violence, outbursts seem to be something common. And there's another theme that kind of the FBI noticed, and it said, well, they said that it's been documented that people who have suffered severe head injuries and ultimately become violent, well, they can become violent. They have a higher risk of becoming violent, even when there was no prior history of violence. And so that was something interesting that they noticed. And there were several other observations made by the people in that symposium. And so the predisposition to serial killing, much like other violent offenses, is biological, social, and psychological in nature. It's not limited to any one specific characteristic or trait. They went on to say that there's no generic template for a serial killer. Serial killers are driven by their own unique motives or reasons. It's not specific to sexual tendencies. They all have their own reason for why they're doing what they're doing. Serial killers are not limited to any specific demographic group, such as their sex, age, race, or religion. The majority of serial killers who are sexually motivated eroticized violence during development. For them, violence and sexual gratification are inexplicably intertwined in their psyche. More research, they decided, is needed to identify specific pathways. There's not a lot of research on this. Something else, there's been some developments in this I talk about whenever it's possible to talk about the research by Dr. Hare. He was a Canadian researcher that came up with the psychopathy checklist, the PCLR. This is a great checklist that kind of tests for psychopathy, and the higher the number, it kind of states the more likely the person is to engage in these types of behaviors. So the interpersonal traits that this checklist talks about includes like glibness, superficial charm, grandiose sense of self-worth, lying, the manipulation of others, impulsivity, behaviors like stimulation-seeking behavior, parasitic orientation, lack of realistic life goals, and antisocial behaviors include poor behavioral controls, early childhood development problems, behavioral problems, juvenile delinquency, things like that. And so research that has demonstrated that in those offenders who are psychopathic, their scores vary, ranging from a high degree of psychopathy. Usually I think it's 26 or above starts talking about, you know, it's pretty, you know, they're like the Jeffrey Dahmer, I think it was like 30 or something, but the higher the number, most likely the more violent or likely they are to be a serial killer. Not all violent offenders are psychopaths, and not all psychopaths are violent offenders. So that's important to note. The relationship between psychopathy and serial killers is particularly interesting. All psychopaths do not become serial murderers, like I just said. Rather, serial murderers may possess some or many traits consistent with psychopathy, but psychopaths who commit serial murder do not value human life and are extremely callous in their interactions with their victims. They don't feel. They don't realize that they're doing anything wrong. They don't feel it. They may know it's wrong, but they don't feel it. They don't have any remorse or empathy for other people. They don't exhibit that. The FBI gave some very good information about myths that are out there about serial killers. So I thought I'd want to talk about some of these myths and kind of intertwine some characteristics and some statistics and facts about that as well. So let's just jump right in. The first myth is serial killers are all dysfunctional loners. This is not true. Most of them are not reclusive social misfits who live alone, hiding in alleyways and things. You may not even know. There are many that hide in plain sight. There are many that live next door. They have families and homes. They're employed. They learn to live life like any other person, like you or I do. They appear to be just normal members of the community. And it could be very difficult to identify one, and that's why sometimes it's hard for law enforcement and the public to find them, because they're your neighbor. Sometimes people have been married to them and didn't even know. For example, the BTK killer, Dennis Rader, he killed 10 people. He was interacting with the police. He was sending letters. He was married with two children, and he was a local government official. He was a president of his church. He did all of these things, and nobody knew that he was this killer. The Green River killer, Gary Ridgway, he confessed to killing 48 people over 21 years. It took that long to catch him. He had been married 3 times. He was employed. He was a painter. He attended church regularly. He read the Bible at work and at home. He talked about religion with his coworkers. And then he would go and pick up prostitutes and engage in sexual activities with them throughout the time that he was killing. There's also, Robert Yates. He killed 17 prostitutes in Washington during the 90s. He was married with 5 children. He lived in a middle-class neighborhood. He was in the Army National Guard. He was a helicopter pilot during the time of the murders. And nobody guessed, you know, he was a killer. So some of the characteristics, you know, I wanted to talk a little bit about this, so... Gender. These are just some facts. 92, and this is facts from the New York Post, so thought they were some interesting facts. 92.5% of serial killers are men, which means 7.5% are women. 51% of them are employed. 51% of serial killers have jobs. 33% are unemployed. 16% are self-employed. And if you want to break down race, let's see, 57.43% of serial killers are white. 29.7% of serial killers are African American. 4.95%, roughly 5%, are Hispanic Latino. 5.94% are Asian. And that leaves other, 1.98% being other. So I thought that was some interesting statistics about them. We can also, some other ones that they've indicated, which is interesting that they have this data. I thought it was great. Childhood, their birth order. 33% of serial killers were the oldest child. 27% were a middle child. 24% were the youngest child. 15% were an only child. Parents, this is something else that was quite interesting. 14% of serial killers were adopted. 78% lived with their birth parents, and then 8% other, so not adopted, not living with birth parents. 8% were in that other category. So let's see. And that leads right into serial killers are all white males. We just talked about that. So that's not true. They're of all races. Charles Ng, he was a native of Hong Kong. He's from China. He killed lots of victims in Northern California. Along with somebody killing with him. It was they're not always just these people who do it on their own. There's also Derek Todd Lee. He was African American. He was killing women in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. There was Roy Condi. He was a Colombian. He was responsible for killing several prostitutes in Miami, Florida. So as you see, it's not just, you know, now the large percentage are white males, but it's not only white males. As we even talked about, there are some female serial killers as well. So the next myth is serial killers are only motivated by sex. Now, this is not true either. They're not all sexually based. There are other motivators for serial killing, including anger, thrill, financial gain, attention seeking. There's a, let's see, I have this whole list of why they do it. And let me see if I can, like in Washington, I'll talk about him first. So in Washington, D.C., there was the D.C. serial sniper case, John Allen Muhammad. He was a former U.S. Army staff sergeant, and he killed primarily for anger and thrill motivations. And so it's not always that it's a sexual in nature. Sometimes it is, but not always. You know, I had a list that I was looking for to talk about the major reasons for serial killers, and I have misplaced it. So, oh, I have it here. Okay. So this is the major list, the motivation behind murders, and it's more statistics. So 32% of motivation behind murders is for enjoyment. And now that sounds so odd, but for simple enjoyment. And then there's 30% for financial gain. Anger is 18%. Gang activity is 10%. And then other reasons is 10%. So those are some of the motivations. Now, moving on to the next myth, all serial murders travel and operate interstate. This is not true. Some have. But most serial murders they have a very defined geographic area of operation. They're very methodical, and they usually stick to a script. They don't change it up. Now, there are some reasons why maybe they would travel, like if they're homeless or their employment takes them away from home and they have to travel. But most of them they don't move from place to place. Another myth is serial killers cannot stop killing. That it is believed that they cannot stop. But there are some that have. There are some that have stopped killing altogether. There are some that take these long breaks. For example, the BTK again, Dennis Rader. He committed crimes and murders from 1974 to 1991. And I think he was captured in 2005. And he stated he stopped killing after 1991. Jeffrey Gordon killed his first victim. Gorton killed his first victim in 1986. And then his next in 1991. He did not kill again until he was captured. And I mean, he did not kill anybody else. And then he was captured in 2002. So some of them do stop. I don't have the reasons as to why they do, but some have. So there's no way to say, oh, they just can't stop. Once they get a taste for it, they can't. No, they do. They stop. Serial killers, here's the next myth. Serial killers are insane or evil geniuses. Now, this is very interesting here because a lot of people think that either they have like a very low IQ or a very high IQ. This is a myth. And this is, a lot of these myths here are saying that it's because of TV and movies about their conditions and how clever or intelligent they are. As a group, serial killers, they suffer from a variety of personality disorders and psychopathy. The most common is antisocial personality disorder. But talking about being evil geniuses, we can talk about their intelligence levels. Their IQ tests have been done on many of them. And let's see, Albert DeSalvo, he had an IQ of 170. Charles Manson, 75. Jeffrey Dahmer, 145. Ted Bundy, 124. John Wayne Gacy, 118. Timothy Lynn Sells, 80. John Straffen, 64. And the most infamous serial predator, Charles Manson, had an IQ of 75. That's below. So the normal range for IQs is 85 to 115. So as you can see, it's all over the place. from even 64, John Streffen, all the way up to 170 with Albert DeSalvo. So then there's even, what's his name? I forget his name. The other serial killer, the really tall guy, he was, they featured him in a show on Netflix. And he had this crazy high IQ as well. I can't remember his name. And so there's not just saying, okay, they're not, you know, all super superior intelligence. They're like everybody else. Now, here's something else that's interesting. Murder methods by average IQ. I thought this was interesting information that the New York Post put out. And so looking at the smarter serial killers that are about 140 or above, their murder methods tended to be using bombs. And then because they would have to build these bombs and things, so they tend to, have higher intelligence. People who used poison were next, and their IQs were roughly approximately around 100. And then strangling, it was right below 100, well, I say 95 to 100. And then stabbing was maybe around 90. A gun was probably around, these are averages, of course, maybe around 85. And then bludgeoning would go to maybe about 78. So those are the statistics given from the New York Post, and these are murder methods by average IQ. And the top murder methods and weapons, the number one murder method used was a gun by 42%. Strangling was 23%, stabbing 15%, bludgeoning was 9%, poison 6%, using an axe 2%, drowning 1%, and then other methods was 2%. And the last myth, serial killers want to get caught. Offenders committing a crime for the first time are inexperienced. They gain experience, they gain confidence as they keep committing crimes. They get better at what they're doing, and they make less and less mistakes. They don't want to get caught. They want to continue without being captured, and they feel empowered. They feel that they'll never get caught. But, you know, TV says, oh, they want to get caught. They like playing the games. You know, some of them do, some of them don't. But for the most part, they don't want to get caught. So a bit ago, I talked about we were talking about IQs, and I mentioned that there was another serial killer that was kind of known for his IQ. It wasn't the highest, it was 145, Ed Kemper, and I remembered his name, I looked it up. So Ed Kemper also had a high IQ. But moving forward, I want to talk about diagnosis and treatment, because earlier I also mentioned that one of the most common diagnoses for serial killers was antisocial personality disorder. And it's in the DSM-5, that's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, in the 5th edition. And this diagnosis is assigned to individuals who habitually and pervasively disregard or violate the rights and considerations of others without remorse. So this is one that has been, it's a common diagnosis amongst serial killers. Now, there are no medications that are routinely used or specifically approved for treatment of antisocial personality disorder, meaning that there's no one test to say, let's get a blood draw and see if this person has this, or here's a medication, take this and your antisocial personality disorder will go away. No, that's not the case for this. And in fact, for many personality disorders, there's no one way to test and there's no one sort of treatment. There are several drugs, though, that can be given to reduce aggression or common problems for people who have been diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, meaning that you sort of treat the symptoms. The best documented medication is lithium carbonate. It has been found to reduce anger, threatening behavior, combativeness in prisoners. And more recently, the drug was shown to reduce behaviors such as bullying, fighting, and outbursts in aggressive children. Dilantin, an anticonvulsant, has also been shown to reduce impulsive aggression in prison settings, and other drugs used to treat aggression. It could be like buspirone, trazodone. So they use some of these to calm people down. So you're treating symptoms. If somebody is very aggressive, you're calming them down. It's kind of like when you have a cold. There's no pill to take rid of the cold, but you can take an expectorant. You can take a cough medicine. You can take something for your sinuses. So you're treating symptoms here. Antipsychotic medications that have been studied in similar populations, they can deter aggression. But they do induce some irreversible side effects, like tranquilizers, benzodiazepine class, should not be used to treat people with antisocial personality disorder because they're very addictive drugs and they could lead to a loss of behavioral control. So, like I was saying, medication can help alleviate other psychotic disorders that coexist, like depression, anti-anxiety disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And so by treating some of the side effects or some of the other coexisting disorders, it can reduce some of the behaviors associated with antisocial personality disorder. And so that can be very helpful. Something else that is helpful in the treatment is talk therapy. It can be very difficult to do because usually in order to engage in productive, helpful therapy, the person you're working with has to be engaged and want to change. And usually you can do things like behavioral modification, teaching people social interaction, teaching people what empathy is, learning to how to interact with people on an everyday basis, social cues, social norms. And like I'm saying, though, the other person, you can't just sit there and force somebody to feel or to think or to want to make changes. They have to want to engage in therapy, and that's how therapy works. So that can be helpful. Many times people in therapy, especially with antisocial personality disorder, they're not in therapy, and if they are, it's because they're forced to, or they're getting treatment because they're incarcerated. Many serial killers don't think that there is actively anything wrong with them, so they would probably not on their own, unless they were apprehended, go into any type of therapy and try to get any sort of treatment. I want to thank you for spending your valuable time listening, and I hope you enjoyed the show. Please subscribe, and if you like the show, leave some nice words, some comments, and good reviews. That would really help the show out a lot. Please search for the show Dissected anywhere you normally listen for your favorite podcasts, including Spotify, Anchor, Pocket Casts, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts. Stay tuned for new episodes every Monday. If you have any questions, feedback, comments, or episode ideas, please email me at dissected.podcast@gmail.com. That's dissected, DISSECTED, .podcast, PODCAST, @gmail.com. Please visit and follow our Instagram page at Dissected Podcast. If you would like to support the show and future episodes, please go to the link in the description. Until next time, don't forget to reward yourselves with self-care and spread kindness. Take care and thank you.